How do you respond to when you see that your cloud asset has been exposed to the internet, whether it's S3 bucket or any other cloud resource, or maybe another scenario where you have your AWS access keys on a social media profile like LinkedIn or GitHub or somewhere else? How do you react? Who do you reach out to? Or what do you do about this? Welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. In this episode, we spoke about digital risk protection and what it means for people who don't know about it. Let me give you another scenario. Imagine you're on LinkedIn. You get this link from a person you've never spoken to before, so you have absolutely should have a zero trust level, but they say there is this awesome cloud security engineer role or cloud security architect role or insert amazing role with an amazing pay. Click on this link for a $20 entry form that you can fill out and we will set you up for this job. Now, this all sounds great, but when you click on that link, they basically get a remote desktop and or they just basically scam you for money. So what do you do in these scenarios? What's your organizational responsibility at that point? Do you let someone in your organization know? Or what if someone's impersonating your organization online and you find out about it? How do you respond to that? So all that and a lot more. Fortunately, I have a friend named Sam who helped me out there. So I had Sam Small from ZeroFox who came in, who demystified digital risk protection for us, DRP for short, for people who don't know about the field. Because I'll be honest, when I was thinking about this topic, I tried Googling and I'm like, what am I searching for? Social media hack? And you know the kind of videos that come for that, right? So definitely don't want that. I just want to know what do I do if my organization, whether it's on cloud or not on cloud, if they are impersonated online, well, how do I react to it? So that's what we spoke about. We also spoke about how do you react to something like this? How do you proactively avoid coming into a scenario like this? And if you do get into a scenario like this, who can you reach out to? So that and a lot more in this episode. This is also our 49th episode. We're just one more episode away from the 50th episode. I'm super grateful that everyone has been so supportive of this podcast for so long, leaving awesome reviews. If you haven't left a review yet, leave a review. Because I did not know this, but apparently reviews are individual to a country. So depending on what country you're in, you may or may not see the awesome reviews that have already been added by so many of the other audience members. So no matter what country you're in, I would encourage you to leave a review because it helps us get a lot of guests. And it really means a lot to me as well when you guys do this. I'm also planning something really exciting for the 50th episode for those people who have interacted with the LinkedIn post. You probably know it. It's a free giveaway that's been given out. I do want my podcast audience, who are my audio-only versions, to be participating in this as well. So I would encourage you, if you would like to participate, please reach out to me at ashish@kaizentech.com or send me a LinkedIn request. But I definitely would love for you guys to get some benefits out of this as well. Free swag, for lack of a better word. But, you know, we'll see how grand we can plan it. But it's our 50th episode, the last episode for the season. We're definitely coming back next year as well, bigger and a lot more guests to kind of and a lot more interesting topics in cloud security. But I want to say thank you for your ongoing support, and I truly appreciate all the reviews you leave. I also appreciate the subscription that you guys do for my YouTube channel as well, and the meetups that we run and the academy that we run. I'm just overall super grateful. Thank you so much again, and I will stop talking before I start crying. I will let you get back to the episode, and I'll talk to you in my 50th episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast with What You Coffee with Ashish. For people who are coming in today, we're talking about digital risk protection and digital shadows. It's always interesting and fascinating to hear what happens online and how do we react to some of the things that happen online to our brand, our organization. So today I have Sam Small, and before we go into get into it, this is a weekly podcast, and today is our 49th episode. We go live every week over here, YouTube, or LinkedIn, I guess wherever you are, and Periscope as well. All right, enough about this, and let me welcome our guest. Hey, Sam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good, good. Thank you so much for taking the time out, and I'm super excited to get into this. So, for Sam, for people who don't know you, what was your path into the cybersecurity world?
Sure. Yeah, so I was a nerd as a young child, which shouldn't surprise anyone because I've remained a nerd well into adulthood. And so I was really interested in computers and video games and all that stuff when I was a kid. And I was, you know, one of those kids that was the last generation of analog and digital together. And so I really got into that stuff. My brother used to let me play with his computer after school and started programming. And so I went to college for computer science. And I was really into studying systems and networking. And those types of things were much more interesting to me pragmatically than theory and algorithms and that kind of stuff. So I found myself studying those things. And it was an interesting time because security wasn't really mainstream yet, and at least in academia. There was academic research happening. But when I went to college, there was lots of classes, but there was no security class for undergraduates because it was really just before that really took off. And so when I got to grad school, I went originally to do research in network systems. But at the time when I joined Johns Hopkins, there was just this like fantastic kind of lightning flash in a bottle or whatever you want to call it, just really smart faculty and students. And I was sitting there in my lab and like, these guys are all really smart and talented and they work on really cool problems. And it's so neat to watch them do things that people say can't be done. And I kind of want to do that. So I found my way, you know, angling to join them and shift from just being systems and network focused to being systems and network security focused. And I changed advisors and started to work with all my really smart friends. And it was fantastic and fun and haven't looked back since. That's all I've done ever since.
That is awesome, man. I'm glad cybersecurity could attract you because we definitely need people who are problem solvers and think very, very differently. This is a really interesting topic, right? I almost wonder, where does one start with this? Because I was trying to Google this and I'm like, oh my God. And I think people like you and I, we have all these, well, for lack of a better word, quote unquote, digital persona of ours created on the internet. And so it also has a digital persona of our organizations as well. And then it just gets into this really complicated world. So just to simplify it for everyone here, what is digital shadow and what is a digital risk protection?
So the concept of a digital shadow, I don't know about that as a term of art. There is a company called Digital Shadows.
Oh, right. I thought it was like more your digital profile was just another name for it. So maybe I should just rename that to digital profile. Ew. My bad.
No, that's all good. It's actually funny because Digital Shadows is a competitor of the company I work for. It's all good. So, but like these names are confusing, right? So like, I always tell people let's break it down. Digital risk protection. What does that mean? Okay, like digital involves computers. Risk sounds like security related. Mm-hmm. There's risks and we want to protect against them. Okay, so you've just described all of computer security. What does that actually mean? But why we call it, there's the analyst community, right? So there's like Gartner and Forrester, and that's what they've decided to call this class of threats and risks. And so it can be difficult if you don't already have a product or know about programmatically like these types of problems and how to solve them in an enterprise security setting. Then when I say digital risk to people, they just think I'm talking about security risks. So what is DRP and what are digital threats and digital risks? In that particular nomenclature, really what it means is kind of anything that targets your business, your employees, your customers, your brand, your executives, any of that type of stuff where the activity is happening kind of beyond the notional concept of your perimeter, right? So we know this idea of like a enterprise perimeter is like, it doesn't really exist, but there still is this concept of control and ownership and the idea that if something bad happens on a machine, whether it's a virtual machine or a physical machine, you know, if it's one of mine or I provisioned it, I can like reach in and stop something bad or I can kind of isolate it from my network or I can deprovision it or turn it off or wipe it. But if there's something happening on a digital platform, a third-party platform, a SaaS application, where I don't have control or visibility or ownership, I have to ask someone else to remove something. And if it's happening on the dark web, there's no one even to ask. So the idea is, you know, it's one thing to protect all that kind of stuff inside your perimeter, but like, how do you proactively identify and then how do you, you know, remediate if you can, mitigate if you can't do that, and assume the risk if you can't do either of those when it's all happening elsewhere, right? And you have to ask someone for help or you have to go through some other channel or you have to, you know, manually go search for these things, you know? And so that's the idea is how do you solve these types of problems? And the reason that we're talking about that now and that this name isn't that familiar or resonant with so many people is because it wasn't a problem that existed like 15 years ago. I wish we had a better name for this category, but I don't think anyone should feel like they missed something, right? This is all relatively new.
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept where a lot of us who are getting into the organization, or I guess getting into organizations or getting into cybersecurity, a lot of conversations are about you should make a blog, you should make a YouTube channel, you could do like there. All the conversations that you hear around how do you stand out so that you get that next cybersecurity job is all about building a digital profile, building a digital profile which is outside of your LinkedIn account, outside of your resume. So what makes you stand out? And to your point, it's fairly, that's also, I mean, not everyone has a blog. Not everyone has a Twitter account where they're ranting about how sad it is, the new feature or whatever. But I feel like it definitely is a conversation we should be having. And this is probably the right time to have this conversation. Also, because I think we were talking about this, where sometimes it's confusing to find out, who do I reach out to? I mean, I can go, hey, Sam, like, I think someone's made a duplicate account for myself or a fake account. How do I react to this? Who do I reach out to? But not everyone does. So I'm definitely keen to kind of go a layer deeper into some of these, like, how do I identify this could be a digital risk? What are the broad categories, if any, for this?
Yeah, sure. So I think the biggest standout one, and probably the easiest one, is impersonation, right? Mm-hmm. So it's difficult for someone to impersonate you on your corporate system, right? Because usually you have to get like hired, and then there's an onboarding process, and you know it's going to be really difficult for someone to show up in your Active Directory domain with the same name as you and a similar email address and all that stuff. But again, like in these digital communities, like you can go on any of these review platforms or any, you know, Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, and you just sign up and you say, this is my display name and this is my avatar or my profile photo. And, you know, this is happening at such a large scale within these communities that people join every day, you know, authentic, real users and maybe bad actors that, I mean, there's no way that, you know, that these organizations that want to grow because the value of a social media company is the size of their community, like, they're not going to put any brakes on signing up new users to verify every single one of them and all those sorts of things. So impersonation is easy, right? Now, what's better than impersonation, but more difficult and more expensive in terms of an investment, would be an account takeover, right? So if I actually was able to get a hold of like your Twitter account, for instance, say you didn't have multi-factor authentication turned on, and let's say your password was like the greatest of all time insecurity is Sam !1. Which, just stop using that password, really. But
I'm sure it's only your password, yes.
But, you know, this is more powerful than impersonation because you have built a community and a sense of trust with your followers. So you have this built-in audience, and anything you say, like, they already have this thing in their head that, like, oh, it's a sheesh. Like, oh, he shared a Bitly link to some cool thing. I'm going to click it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous. That's dangerous whether you're a person or an enterprise or an organization or anything like that. And if you think back to like more classical computer security problems or network security problems, and we think about, you know, in the early 2000s, we saw like a lot of worm activity, and worms kept getting more sophisticated. And one of the ways that worm authors found they could get really explosive growth early on in terms of saturation across the internet was to have a hit list. They would go out ahead of time and find me all the servers that are vulnerable to the exploit I'm going to use to propagate this worm. And let me start with that hit list, because then I know I can spray, you know, 1,000 victims immediately before I have to start scanning the IP space to look for potential victims. And so it's kind of that similar idea of like, if I take over your account and you have a lot of followers, there's not even a question of, is this the real Ashish account? Because we chatted before on here, and I can trust him because every other message I've seen him post like wasn't scammy or dangerous or anything like that. So that's another big issue. Yeah. And that kind of plays into the other issues. Like, okay, well, then what do you do once you have fooled someone, once you've broken that kind of assumption of trust around identity? Well, then you have all kinds of stuff, right? Then you have your scams and fraud and like kind of social-based phishing. It might be malware delivery. It might be like a drive-by download by sending you to a page and having a vulnerable browser or plugin. It might be by asking you to log into a page that looks like some other person's page. It might be giving you directions to follow on your computer. Like, hey, you want to improve security on your computer? Go follow, you know, change these settings in your computer. it could be any of those things. Because once you've abused trust, people are willing to do whatever they would trust you to tell them to do.
Yeah, I find that fascinating, because this is just an individual level. There's an organization level as well. I think one of the categories also is around the fact that you have exposed cloud assets. And being the Cloud Security Podcast, I wanted to bring that angle as well. As an organization, we used to call it shadow IT in the on-premise world. Now it's like shadow cloud, for lack of a better word, where someone just had a credit card with a big enough, I guess, a corporate credit card with a big enough limit that you could just swipe and go, all right, my entire infrastructure is going to be on AWS or Azure or Google. I do not care. But as a security person, that's a digital risk protection. For me, as a security guy, A, identifying that I already have that exposed somewhere, that's a challenge because there is no way. I mean, honestly, you're using the existing network. Now, because of COVID, everyone's working from home. So, hey, I don't even know if they're actually there. So do you find that at an organization level, is that similar? Like the whole impersonation thing? Or like I'm representing Cloud Security Podcast, but then there's another Ashish somewhere in another country who's just like promoting it to a completely different audience and probably uses the same episodes.
Yeah, of course it is. I still consider that shadow IT or shadow SaaS. And I think there's other problems there too, right? I mean, most organizations have traditionally gone like all in on one cloud provider. But even now, you know, the people more at the cutting edge of this stuff are like, you shouldn't rely on just one cloud provider. So you should have like a multi-cloud provider, so, you know, strategy and all those sorts of things. And those are great points. But now the other problem is most organizations, especially as they get larger, there's a lot of redundant services as well. So like a lot of organizations, like they'll use Dropbox for some things or Google Drive for some things, but then they use box.com for other things. And so there's like all these different places where you could have shared files and you could have different permissions on all of them and different RBAC on all of them. And the problem is they don't all offer the same controls, nor do they offer similar like language or configuration language even around those things. And so it's easy to get something wrong on one system that you got right on another system. And because these are all SaaS applications, you know, you don't typically have any control or visibility over to when they upgrade the system, right? So if they change the way they do RBAC, or they change they add some more granular permissions in one of their like silent SaaS updates, you might not even be aware of that. And it might expose you in a way that you hadn't thought of, or it might, you know, come with a fail open or fail closed sort of control. So you just don't know. And that makes it really difficult. And I think that goes to, you know, all the work that we have to do here.
Right. So, but it's, the more people hear about the problem space, the more it's like, oh my God, like at any given point in time, I have no idea what's out there. Like none of us are scrolling the internet to find, hey, who's representing my name? And most fortunately, because of the internet, we've kind of identified all of us have very common names, right? Is this the same as a threat intelligence? Like, because it sounds a lot more like I'm looking out for threats and looking out for digital shadows. So is this similar or is it different?
So like in a lot of my slides, when I talk about these issues, I have a Venn diagram. And in this Venn diagram, there's digital risk protection, and then there's the overlap with cyber threat intelligence. And in particular, what we're really talking about is kind of external cyber threat intelligence, if there is a distinction to be made there. You can't do DRP, digital risk protection, without cyber threat intelligence. And so then what's the difference? You ask 10 people what threat intelligence is, you'll get 10 different answers. But so we won't go into that. But you know, when I think about threat intelligence, I really think about like threat data. And then it's like, what do you do with that data? You typically would like use that data to like enrich or contextualize or prioritize things that are specifically germane to your concerns or risks or business and those sorts of things. So then what's digital risk protection? Digital risk protection is like more of a programmatic feature of a security group or program, right? For lack of a better word, to repeat myself. But and that is really about what is our plan? Like what's the process? What's the technology? And who are the people that are going to be responsible for taking these signals, applying them through the lens of our risks, and then deciding what is to be done about them, whether that is responding or whether that's going back to our configurations and maybe improving some of our controls, or whether it's developing better relationships with some of these providers that have digital collaboration systems that we are constantly being attacked on, or our customers are being targeted and our brand is being abused to target them, et cetera. Cyber threat intelligence is a part of DRP, and DRP is really more in the same way that you have an application security program in a typical enterprise security team, and you're logging and auditing and compliance things. Like DRP is a programmatic feature. And so you can talk about the maturity of digital risk protection in terms of where you are today, where you want to be tomorrow, how the landscape's changing, but cyber threat intelligence will always be a part of that.
Right. So it's almost like a subset. Would that be a fair statement then? So
I feel like it's a superset. It all kind of depends on what you want to do with cyber threat intelligence. You can use cyber threat intelligence to create academic research. You can use it to evaluate the
next zero day or whatever.
Yeah, or even evaluate like how good are CVSS scores in truth when we look back. And you can use cyber threat intelligence data for that. But digital risk protection is using cyber threat intelligence to understand what your attack surface is, what the activity is across that attack surface externally, and then having the responsibilities and playbooks around dealing with those issues and the incident response when those things are actually a problem.
It's an interesting segue into my next question. I guess anyone executive level who's listening to this or a managerial level listening to this from a security standpoint, they're like, I don't think we have any social profile. I don't need to worry about this. Put a risk lens onto this. What kind of risk are we talking for an organization that digital risk protection is protecting them against?
Yeah, well, so there's like a really classic one that people maybe wouldn't even consider as digital risk protection. And I think that's one of the things here that's tough is like, we have all these kind of risks and maybe like by themselves, they all seem unrelated. So like DRP is an attempt to add some sort of system or taxonomy or clustering to these things because they have some similarities, but they aren't always obvious. So to your question, if you think about phishing, like classic email phishing, you know, that's usually done through an impersonating domain. It's not an impersonating account on a social media platform, but someone went to a domain registrar and they registered, you know, the name of your show, you know, plus something else or add a different TLD.us, even though you're clearly, you know, in Australia. So identifying those signals, like even just watching domain registrations and comparing that to your personal brand and terms that would associate that domain with you through just the, you know, someone who's reading that domain name or receives an email from that domain name, likewise to your business, even taking those signals as cyber threat intelligence data and then applying it into your DRP program, that's useful. But then again, how do I prioritize, like let's say you have a really common name, as you mentioned earlier, and like these things are popping up all the time. So like part of DRP is also like not only taking in that data, but then like applying some kind of logic or rules or natural language processing or something to help kind of weed out the signal from the noise. And then on top of that, there's other things that like your digital risk protection program should have as a mature capability, which would be like, okay, I'm going to watch this domain name and these other 1,000 domain names. I'm not going to do anything about it until there's an MX record that pops up behind that domain, or there's an A-name record and now there's a website. And then, so I'll escalate that to a higher priority. But then even there, if it's an A-name record and a website goes live, again, it might just be a similarity. So now I'm going to watch the page and see, do they ever use any copy from my webpage or any of my stuff? Or do they ever use a photo that looks like me? Or do they ever use an image that looks like my brand image? And so, and in that, I escalate even higher. And now, that's how you get severities. And you're like, this is critical. Someone has a website up. They're pretending to be us. They've got a login page. They're using all of our stuff. Like, this is like, we can't ignore this any longer, this goes to the top of the triage list. And then there's all the things to do about it.
Yeah. And I think so, to your point, it's almost like a brand reputational risk as well at that point. You're like, are you okay for someone else to be www.apple.com and just trying to sell Apple AirPods? Someone just like putting a fake website out there, and would Apple be okay with it? Are they like,
and let me tell you why they wouldn't be okay with it. So let's say I bought Apple AirPods cheap.us or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I'm sure that happens all the time. But if on that page, there's a sign in with your Apple ID right here and people enter in their Apple ID credentials, Apple certainly cares about that. Right. Because now they're going to have to deal with, you know, chargebacks or, you know, even just the volume on their customer support line. If that page gets, you know, popular and people are like, I'm locked out of my account and I never got the AirPods and all that stuff. So it really does become a cost to organizations. And if you think about kind of like fraudulent transactions and bank fraud and those sorts of things, it has some similarities in that, like, look, we're never going to eliminate this risk, but like, can we do reasonable things to keep this risk bounded under a certain level where then we can reason through, you know, around costs and or insurance and or other things so that this is a planned expense. And our CFO will be happy that we're not going to end up, you know, having a surge in customer support costs at the end of the year or something like that.
Oh, right. So it's not a state emergency every time you find out there's a fake Apple website and CFO is like, why would you not plan for this? There's no budget for this.
Right.
I've got a good question here from Vineet as well. It's a good segue. Do they have any digital brand protection at the moment, apart from going to take a legal action? Is there something that can be done?
Of course. I mean, yeah, so this is a whole product category. So, the company I work for, ZeroFox, like this is something that we sell to commercial businesses and enterprise businesses and people that have a higher social profile. And there's other vendors in this space as well. And if you want to learn more about this in a vendor agnostic or neutral way, you can go onto your favorite search engine and look up, for instance, like Forrester or Gartner's publications on digital risk protection. Just put digital risk protection in quotes and file type PDF or, you know, whatever you want to do, you'll find some stuff to read. Also, I'm happy, you know, if people want to connect with me on LinkedIn, I'm happy to give them some resources that, again, are agnostic to any particular provider. There is this whole market here, but again, it didn't exist 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I think just to take a leaf from his question as well, the legal question part is also not straightforward as well, right? You can't really just, I'm going to the help desk of Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or any of these social media or even LinkedIn for that matter. I'm going to just sue you guys and like, yeah, good luck. See ya.
Yeah, well, look, I was talking to the CISO of one of like the hottest newer FinServe companies recently about this issue. And he's like, well, my legal team takes care of all that stuff. And I'm like, oh, you should revisit this, right? So, you know, honestly, this is a challenge. And the reason I talk again about digital risk protection rather than threat intelligence is these issues require collaboration with your security team, your marketing team or communications team, and your legal team. And if you put it in only one of those three or two of those three, you're not going to be doing this efficiently and you're not going to be doing it effectively. And that's because asking your legal team to be experts in fast identification of threat intelligence signals that are abusing, like they don't have those skills and they're very expensive. But likewise, I wouldn't ask my security team, who's really great at like using tools or writing scripts to do all that proactively. They're not great at writing a cease and desist letter. At the same time, a cease and desist letter is not the fastest way to get something removed, especially when it's clearly violating some terms of service or some law. It's a little complicated, but there are certain things that like your security team can handle on their own. If there's someone pretending to be you on a social media platform and they have a link that, you know, is a phishing site or malware, you can go directly to that platform and ask them to take it down. And you don't need to be a lawyer or any of that kind of stuff. But now sometimes there are other issues with other providers in other countries, and you try all those things that you can automate or do with your L1 or L2 analysts. And you hit a wall and you're like, okay, now someone needs to send like a cease and desist letter. Okay, now that goes to legal. Or now, or maybe, you know, you write a report to show legal, hey, our brand abuse risks are really growing quarter after quarter. We need to invest more in this or what have you. And likewise, when marketing registers 10 new domains for a product that's just about to launch or a service that they just are about to launch, like they need to tell the security team ahead of time so they don't identify those domain registrations and say, oh shoot, like someone's about to impersonate us, let's go take all those down. And all of a sudden your CMO is at your door like, you just, like, we're a week behind on our launch now because you just had all of our domains taken down. You're like, but you didn't tell us you were registering them, so we thought they were impersonations. So that coordination is super important. You can't just think about this as threat intelligence because that's just too small of a scope to look at this as a real like process issue.
And to bring it home for some of the cloud security kind of conversations as well, I think some of the common use cases, which kind of are very similar, is a lot of organizations, I'm going to use an AWS example, where exactly your point, you have a domain, which you thought you were keeping it on your dev environment or test environment for some time, you thought you deleted it, it still hangs around somewhere, someone's just able to go create an AWS account and link that to a Route 53 because AWS likes AWS. So it's easy to link up because you can search a global directory of AWS. Suddenly, someone has your domain, your website, but it's actually their website. But yeah, the scenarios that you can come up with is just like amazing to me. And I find that really interesting. I've got another one which I came across, and I love it, how it's common on LinkedIn for people to share resumes, share links, to your point about the shortened URL earlier. And like, never met these people and they give you links to share. Oh, click on this link because this is the best job you would ever look for. Or this is that interview that I was talking about. Like, it amazes me till today when people just simply click on a link that they would never heard from this guy for the first time. I had this job for you, best job in the world. Click on this resume and you do not want to miss this job. And you click on
sometimes
that link,
it's even worse. Sometimes it's even worse, like, because we're in the security industry and my best friend is, he's an amazing hacker. Oh, and I won't even click on his links because I know he's trying to get control of my machine. So like, I can't even trust my best friend with a link. You know, so to the point, it's tough, especially if it's with someone you don't know.
In general, if you're trying to reach out to people on social media, don't probably try with a link in your first message. Definitely not. I just probably put that out there. But I think to your point, we have a whole social engineering field as well that we've created in cybersecurity now. Is there like an overlap between that and this?
Out of curiosity. Definitely. In my mind, I always kind of think like what we have today in terms of these digital risks is really like social engineering. Went to college and learned some new skills and the internet blew up. This is the new social engineering. It used to be a lot harder. Like I used to actually have to go to the town that the company was in that I wanted to social engineer. And I had to like buy a fake costume and a fake mustache and like get a water, you know, container and like go in and pretend to be there to deliver the water and then sneak into the network closet. That's like, that takes time. It's expensive. I can only do that so much. Now all I have to do is like, I don't even have to come up with a really great phishing email or fake impersonation, because if I spread that across a large enough audience, even if the yield rate is super low, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, 0.5% of 100,000 attempts is still going to be valuable and worth my time. And it doesn't cost a penny to create one of these accounts on these networks. Now, it costs a little bit of money to set up maybe some of the infrastructure for like if you want to host a phishing kit or register a domain, but that's still pennies, right? And you still have, you know, the number of people that are on the internet, surely like the large of law numbers, there's going to be stupid people. There's going to be unsophisticated people. There's going to be people who are just distracted. There's going to be people that, you know, so it runs the gamut. And even the smartest people fall for these things because of pretexting and all that kind of stuff. This is the new face of social engineering. And if you were a criminal, it's the better face of social engineering because you're even farther away. You're like, well, my cell phone wasn't in the vicinity of that. You know, like I watch a lot of the show Forensic Files, and it's always like someone will go do something terrible to someone, and it's like they have their cell phone in their pocket their whole time. And then they're like, oh, I wasn't there. It's funny because your cell phone was. And so again, like, it's great. Like I can be in some other country that doesn't have extradition laws and, you know, and I can attack anyone in the world or, you know, target anyone in the world.
That's a good segue into Chris's question. Is this activity a trend on the rise?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And especially I think with people at work from home, I think criminals are taking advantage of this like rapid shift that a lot of IT teams and security teams have had to deal with, which was, you know, traditionally, remote work was more of an exception, and now it's the rule and the expectation. In 2019, CISOs were applying their budgets to solutions and products that were more assumptive over this work from home exception. And so all this stuff that we had invested in to protect the enterprise and secure our enterprise systems and assumptions that we had around the way that we configured and set those things up has been blown out of the water. And, you know, for some companies, it's not a big deal because they were already using a ton of SaaS stuff and they had their things. But there's other types of businesses where they were never going to allow anyone to remote log in to touch that particular data. Like you can maybe think of cases like in healthcare or other types of critical systems. And now they have to deal with that. And you have people at home on their work machine. And like, they're probably doing stuff they wouldn't normally do on their work machine because there's no one in the cubicle next to them or walking by them. And so they're visiting these sites and clicking on these links perhaps, or even they're doing it on their home computer, but it's on the same network as their work computer is in. And again, like corporate security team doesn't do anything to protect your home network. So it's complicated. And there's a lot of things that are going to fall through the cracks and cyber criminals are going to take advantage of that. And because people aren't outside and aren't doing these things, and because there is so much uncertainty around these new procedures and protocols, it's even easier to get someone to believe that, you know, like, hey, I'm your new coworker. We haven't met yet. I'm joining the team on Monday. You know, there's anything you can imagine, right? Like, it's just hard.
Imagine those ones as well, where you have a new staff member who hasn't had an email created. They reach out from their personal email saying, hey, just reaching out because I haven't had my email being issued yet. Could you help me get access to this machine? Yeah. And like, just after that, because that is a real scenario these days. You can't
And research that we've conducted that show this growth and show these trends. The FTC just published, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States just published a report like about a month ago about the rise in social media scams and the rising costs in them as well. And in addition to that, there's plenty of data and research. Inflection point at COVID-19. Where we saw a rise in these scams as well, to back up the anecdotal stuff we were talking about a moment ago.
That is scary stuff, man. I've got team members who started remotely. A lot of people are talking about social challenges, but somehow security kind of got, we need to be able to just connect people quickly. We had this like 1 or 2 month window where it was like almost like a do or die. So yeah, I totally.
Well, yeah, of course. If you have to choose between business continuity and being secure from all risks, corporate board or CEO is going to choose business continuity, and you can't blame them, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Because you got to keep trying to make money, and obviously you want to do that in a secure way possible.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like saying, "Oh, we need to do the right way, so I need to evaluate this for a month before I can let people have VPN connections or anything else." It blows my mind, but. This leads to another question, right? So we've kind of like talked about social media. We spoke about social engineering. We even touched upon the rise due to COVID-19. And you touched on the point that people obviously have, like, I've got two laptops over here. I've got a MacBook here, and a MacBook here. Like, I've got three machines already. One of them, well, none of
are
them
we are comparing? Are we comparing? I've got a Mac Mini, my laptop, my iPad, two iPhones.
No, but I was starting to say that, like, you know, I imagine it's the same situation at a lot of home places as well, because before COVID, a lot of us were asked to get a personal laptop. Don't use your work laptop for your personal things. Now, with homeschooling and a lot of people not having individual laptops for their kids, like, everyone's blending into your work laptop, right? And now,
yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that, you know, there used to be this thing that, like, bring your kid to work day, and like, oh, that's cool, and people like that. But would anyone be okay with bring your kid's device to work day?
Oh,
I don't think so.
That's right. Because nowadays they have iPads and iPhones which connect to a Wi-Fi and they want to be online. You want your kids to be watching YouTube or something else so that they don't scream their heart out in the office. Not that all kids scream. To add to that, now imagine in a state where I was going back to my example of LinkedIn was used as a medium. Someone gave me a link. I clicked on it. Somehow they got a remote chill back onto the machine. All right. I'm like, oh, shit. I need to inform someone. I call up security. I go, hey, Sam, I think I might have screwed up over here. I think I have a remote desktop or something. Now, at that point, although because LinkedIn is kind of like the medium, it's not responsible for it.
I call it the tip of the spear, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like that penetrated the outer layer. And then we went to a more traditional type of attack, and now you have malware or ransomware. And so now you've got few things to deal with. Yeah,
that's right. And as a response team, people are looking for, oh, how do I get to the point of origin? How do I able to go to the next level and find out what are my options there? Because, like, are people like LinkedIn and, well, I don't want to get banned from LinkedIn, but in case, you guys are awesome. Yeah, that's right.
And my friends that work at LinkedIn are especially awesome.
You go. That's right. In case you guys are listening to this conversation. But to your point, if they are a tip of the spear, as you mentioned, like, what other options is there? Then should we be reaching out to LinkedIn? Like, how do you respond to this kind of a thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's the right question to ask. And it's the right question to ask before it happens, right? Because, like, a lot of times what I see happen is, unfortunately, like, you know, security's tough because it's a cost center, and, like, you could spend infinite money on your security team and tools and budgets and people and all that stuff. And one of the consequences of that is sometimes until something bad happens in a certain avenue, like, no one's going to spend any money on a solution for it yet. So unfortunately, it's too often that organizations don't have any programmatic way to deal with this until something bad happens. There's something I often say here is, do you want to lead the narrative, or you want the narrative to lead you? Do you want to find these things proactively and deal with them proactively? Or do you want to get, like, an angry phone call from, you know, someone on the executive team or a board member or a reporter saying, what's your comment on this data breach on the dark web? And you're like, what, can you give me the link? And then you don't want to spend, like, 2 hours, like, right at the time of the incident, like, Twitter, you know, like, Twitter security team email address in your search engine, or, like, how to escalate my problem to the LinkedIn security team. Because, like, if that's where you are in the first, you know, 2 or 3 hours of your response plan, like, the blast radius is still growing from the actual problem. This kind of is a parallel to what we talked about earlier with cloud security controls. And everyone does it differently. And that lack of homogeneity makes things difficult and inefficient. You have the same thing with all these digital platforms. Every digital platform has a different mechanism and expectations and protocol or avenue from which to report things. And they all want you to report different things in different ways, whether it's through a form or an email. And you have to provide these artifacts, which may be, you know, screenshots or links, or maybe even a copy of your brand and trademark authorization. And so it's different on every single one. And the expectations around response time and takedown time, or having to know exactly what clause of their terms of service to call out, it's a mess. And so there's a lot that needs to be improved here. And that is why digital risk protection as a vendor solution or a partner solution, that's why that's attractive to so many businesses, because they're like, this is really messy. I don't want my team to have to become experts in these skills in addition to all the other SOC management skills they already have. So can we outsource this to some other group who focuses exclusively on these problems? That's why I'm able to pull a paycheck every 2 weeks. And that's why the company I'm with continues to grow and the other vendors in the space continue to grow, because it is really messy. And you don't want to be the best in the world at securing your business and also have to be the best in the world at doing your own DIY digital risk protection program with your own tools and people and processes from scratch, because it's unforgiving and the volume could change at any moment. You know, you could have the perfect staffing for the attack volume you have today, but tomorrow you might go viral. Your business might become really popular, or attackers might, you know, become really interested in your business overnight. And that's why we exist.
Sure. People talk about cybersecurity awareness training, right? Mm-hmm. And you can put all the things in the world, don't click on a link on your email. But I wonder how many people actually cover don't click on a link on a LinkedIn profile or a Facebook profile. I wonder.
It's a lot less prevalent. And I've seen some data in the past that, like, we've actually done a pretty good job of training people not to click links on emails from people they don't know or haven't met. And so I think the last numbers I saw, which might be old, was like there was like a 10% chance that like an employee would click a link for someone they didn't know. But the percentage of people who would accept a LinkedIn a request from someone they didn't know or hadn't met was like 40%. And again, when we think about those trust things again, of like, well, there's a picture and there's a name and like there's a history of communication that like makes this person really seem authentic and legitimate. But like,
yeah, clearly, all those things. This person seems to work in Apple. For sure, he's an Apple employee. It's like, yeah. It's like, you know, how I find our professional worlds are moving to a place where earlier when Facebook was still getting popular, people would be like, oh, well, it's not official until it's on Facebook, right? There used to be that, like, people would use that phrase quite often. I feel like it's a similar thing with LinkedIn as well these days, or any of the professional media platforms on Twitter as well, because you can be verified or not verified, whatever. But it's becoming true over there as well. Like, people kind of feel like, oh, if it's not on LinkedIn, I don't believe it. Because I could be just saying, I'm just like this amazing billionaire doing this from my cockpit or whatever. But it just happens to be a green screen at the back. It's actually a cockpit, wherever take off. But it's actually becoming quite common.
That's right, because I could like stalk some Instagram pages of LinkedIn employees or employees of any company, and I could probably find a picture where one of them's wearing their work badge. And then I could just like Photoshop my own. And then I could wear that in one of my pictures. I mean, there's all these like little, like tiny little kind of ways you can use
Photoshop has made a lot of things possible.
Yeah,
Photoshop is just amazing. But that begs another question, though. So it's great that we've kind of identified the problem space. We've spoken about it. We've spoken about, I guess, how you can probably proactively deal with it as well to some extent.
Yeah,
maybe through cybersecurity awareness or whatever. But you can use some vendors to do tracking. But is there like a maturity level to this as well? Like, how do you go from, like, in your mind, some of the people you may have helped or the conversations you've had, what's a good maturity versus like, oh, you guys should up your game?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'd give different answers depending on like if you're an individual or you're a business, and then kind of what kind of business, and are you a business that has a lot of interaction or relies on these other digital platforms to conduct your business. So for instance, there's a lot of businesses now today that do initial customer support over, like, they're watching for people to complain about some or ask a question, a technical support question or something. Twitter's become really popular for that, for instance. So for any business that does a lot there or is maybe an online only business, it's gonna be like super important, and especially financial services industry, because the direct line between some sort of attack and actual cash, that line is so short, whereas maybe other types of businesses, it requires a few hops. Those people clearly need to be really assessing your maturity and trying to get there as quickly as possible. But it all goes back down to risk calculus, right? So the first thing you got to do is, you know, like, understand how much of a risk is this for us? What are the potential repercussions? This is where in security, we do a lot of tabletop exercises and things like that. I think that's one way you can try to baseline your maturity and understand, okay, well, if this were to happen to us today, we're not happy with what our response would be or our level of risk that we would have to assume is. So where do we want to be? How do we get there? What's a reasonable amount of time and budget and spend and all that kind of stuff? So it's not an easy question to answer, but there's a way to do it. And again, I mean, if anyone wants to go more into that offline, I'm happy to answer and discuss that further.
Yep. Awesome. And I think it's just a great way to put this across as well, because a startup may be worried because they might have some seed funding, or they would want to make sure that the impression that they make on the future venture capitalists that they would get money from is not hampered. And they have a trust, certain level of trust that they create. But on the other extreme, then you would have, say, brands which have been there for years, where they were never online, but now they're suddenly online. So some of their staff may not be trained for, they have marketing teams or growth teams who may help them go online, but they necessarily would not know, like, if they would be trained enough to not respond to this appropriately. Like, do they actually know that you should reach out to security people? If they say, this looks like a bit of a suspicious thing, I think I found a fake profile of, I don't know, insert company here. If you look at social media as well, how often do you find people who use someone else's image as their image? Which is like, I don't know why people do that, but I feel like it's really interesting how people would rather have a celebrity face on their profile instead of their own face.
Yeah,
that makes I'm like, oh, okay.
I see that all the time. Yeah.
And I wonder if people do that on LinkedIn though. Have you seen one on LinkedIn yet?
I've seen fake LinkedIn profiles where people are trying to run like HR recruiting scams. Like, hey, we want to hire you, but just like send us your resume and a $20 application fee. I've seen a lot of those types of things. I think the other thing that's kind of related to kind of what you were talking about that I was thinking about a moment ago is, you know, when a company doesn't take this seriously, there's like other types of problems. You know, when you don't deal with brand abuse, it can really affect the trust and confidence people have in your brand. So I'll just give an example without calling out the specific company. There's a sunglasses manufacturer, and for many years, people were abusing their brand on like Facebook and Twitter in particular, like posting a photo of their very popular sunglasses brand with like 20% off, follow this link. And it got so bad that it was just always this one brand that, like, I'm to the point now where as a consumer, I will never click on any advertisement, even if it's legitimate from that company, because I've just been trained to condition that, like, scam. Like, the first thing I think of when I see a digital ad from this company is scam. That doesn't mean I wouldn't buy their sunglasses, but I'm only going to do so maybe in person or if I directly go to their domain. But then that kind of blows up their whole digital advertising campaign. Yeah. And any spend that they put in digital advertising and marketing, because they didn't take care of this, it's very ineffective. Like, they're getting pennies on the dollar of their investment, whereas like someone else who is very aggressive about dealing with brand abuse, like, they get a dollar. You know, they get a dollar value for a dollar spend on their digital ads.
And I think Chris just mentioned a comment. So he said, even ASOS, this Australian Security Intelligence Organization, is now campaigned to watch out for foreign interference approaches on social media. It's amazing how before cloud and before social media, we used to all be worried about someone would get into our network. But now it's almost like we're already outside the network.
When I was young, it was like, you have to get EIP or you got to get the instruction pointer. And it was tough. And you could bang your head against the wall forever. And I'm jealous.
Well, there's so many guys who are doing bug bounties. Like, yeah, 100%. To your point, even if out of a 10,000 or 100,000, I get 1% hit rate, that's still pretty good hit rate.
Yes.
And I just automate the whole thing, just keep spamming the internet for it. It's like a billion people out there on the internet.
Exactly. You only need to be right once. And with such a large pool of potential victims, you know, it's a better option for some people than whatever opportunities they may have in their community or given their other options or whatever. Maybe they just don't care. I can't get into the psychology of why people do illegal things or scam people, but it's always going to be there. There's always going to be people, you know, who are too trusting. There's going to be people who take advantage of that. And then there's going to be somewhere in the middle where, you know, they're going to try to catch someone when their guard's down.
Yeah. And I think it's this human rule, right? Good people, bad people.
Well, good day, bad day, right? Like,
that's right.
You know, it's less about that and more just like, you made a bad decision and you made it for too long.
That's right. Say, is there something about this space? Because I know this space is quite new as well. I mean, like, it's been there for a while, but now there's a term for it. Is there something that you feel people should talk more about in the space that they may not be talking about at the moment?
Yeah. So again, you know, I still meet like really smart, accomplished, experienced CISOs, and you talk about these issues, and they still don't fully like understand or appreciate the just how deep and how dangerous these things can be, and not dealing with them. And at the same time, like, I give them a pass on that, because I still think, you know, even like 20 years into all the basic stuff that's in like the SANS 20, or which is now the SIS, you know, 20, like we're still struggling at so many organizations dealing with the blocking and tackling of asset management and vulnerability management and prioritization and identity and authentication and password security. So I get it that like, it's just one more thing to be like, oh, like I'm not done with this yet. And now you want me to pay attention and invest in that. So, you know, I do think though that like us as security executives, like and security program managers and leaders need to get more up to speed on that and understand the kind of where it sits, you know, shoulder to shoulder with these other things. That's one thing. And I think the other thing that people should be paying attention to is we've really let these digital platforms kind of move at their own pace and their own speed and set the expectations for businesses and consumers who are being targeted or who are facing brand abuse or any of these sorts of things on these platforms. And I think the power is a little too much in their on their end of the spectrum. And what I would like to see, and I'm not calling for like regulation or law necessarily anything, but I would like to see a little more kind of commitment or consistency around the expectations and the automation and the maturing on their side, because we can't we can build all the tools and systems we want to automate finding and reporting these things. I can't force any of them to invest more in handling the, you know, increases or changes in volume or codifying, you know, what they're going to do or what the expectations are or standardizing that communication.
And I truly hope that the kind of learning as it's growing, because it is around us. I have to tell people about when they do security awareness training as well. Internet is still, like, I think no one expected a small network that a university is going to start. It's going to turn into this massive thing that's going to connect the world. It happened so quickly and all around us. And we've gotten used to it. We're introducing our kids to it. We're introducing our families to it, our parents into it. And thank
God for it too, because if COVID-19 was here and we didn't have, if this wasn't already all here, I mean, yes, I hate being on Zoom all day, but at least I can be on Zoom. Like, you know, I just can't even imagine if we were trying to do this on the telephone for the last, you know, 7, 8, 9 months, however long it's been, right?
Yeah, that's right. But I guess to close off that point as well, where totally grateful for all this, but at the same time, people like you and I and others who are kind of watching out for, hey, what does this really mean? Because I think it's more about generating awareness of this as well. It's not like saying, oh, this is like a dark world, stay away from it. It's just more like you need to be aware of what you're getting into as well.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be like if you spend all your time putting locks and sensors on all the doors and windows on the front of your house and like totally ignoring the fact that, you know, the back door to the basement like is wide open.
So this is probably where we're moving into the last section of our podcast. Dude, I just want to say thank you so much for coming in, man. I think I got a lot of value out of this. I'm sure the audience did as well based on the questions, but this was really awesome for me. Where can people find you online? It's going to connect with you and find out more about this topic.
Yeah, sure. The social, you know, platform I'm most engaged and involved in is LinkedIn for, you know, any of this stuff professionally. And so just connect with me on LinkedIn. And if it develops, then we'll move to email or phone or a video chat or whatever. But like, that's the easiest way for me to manage inbound stuff, I think. And then if you want to learn more about this stuff, again, just put like digital risk protection in quotes. Be wary of like where the information's coming from, because if it's coming from a vendor, even if it's my company, like everyone's got their own spin on what they think the most important things should be, because that's what they do really well and sell. So you use your best judgment. There are plenty of people who've written about these topics, et cetera, that aren't affiliated with the vendor. And again, I'm more than happy to like share those resources and others with anyone who's interested. It only takes me a minute to copy and paste links. So it's really awesome. No bother.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to bring you back again, man. This has been awesome. Oh, so thank you so much for spending time on this.
I would love to have coffee with you even if we weren't live streaming it. So let's not miss the opportunity.
I will definitely be following up on that as well, Sam. Thanks so much for coming in, man. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me on the show. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to that episode of Cloud Security Podcast. If you found some new information from that episode, we would appreciate if you share it with others. Share it with us as well if you have any good feedback or good learnings from the episode. We are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you don't find us there, you can always go on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv, to listen to the latest episode. We appreciate your support in helping us grow. It helps us bring more guests. It helps us support the channel. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, and talk to you on the next episode.